Everybody is sobered by the advance of prophecy. This is a sermon in a way about prophecy, but in a way it's not about prophecy at all. Another way, it's almost entirely about prophecy. You say, no, well, how can you give a sermon that's almost entirely about prophecy, and yet in another way it's not about prophecy at all? Well, after you hear the sermon, see if you agree. You'll just have to hear it. But when people think of prophecy, they think of things like this statement that came out 5 days ago in most of the papers of the country, I would imagine. This is out of the Cleveland Plain Dealer. And it's sobering to look at articles like this one. I'll be reading some others of a different kind. But it's sobering, and it's natural to think of statements like this one as statements or articles or events depicting the advance of prophecy. From Vatican City, the article is entitled, Pope Upholds Church's Statement on Primacy. Pope John Paul II took personal responsibility yesterday for a controversial Vatican assertion of the primacy of the Roman Catholic Church, saying it was wrong to see it as a belittling of other religions. Now, he tried to spin it and put his nice velvet glove around an iron fist in the middle of that statement as he could, tried to sprinkle sugar on top of the velvet glove, which was still on top of an iron fist. But in the end, it's obvious, he said, the statement came from me, that the Catholic Church is primary, and that all other religions, as he says in this article again, are in a gravely deficient situation regarding salvation. Well, when you understand the rest of the 36-page declaration that Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, the German Cardinal of Enforcement, released, you recognize gravely deficient situation is probably putting it nicely. They're saying, you're not going to heaven. Of course, you and I don't want to go to heaven, but out there in the world they do. And when the Catholic Church stands up and says, it's our way or no way, that shocks a lot of people. So a lot of people say, well, it's not really coming from the Pope. The Pope said, oh, yes, it is. Even though it's sort of cut against the grain of his 22-year papacy of ecumenism, and so forth. And some rabbis walked out of the Jewish Vatican Catholic dialogue, the kind of committee meeting that was planned for this week because they're protesting it. Well, when you hear articles like that, you realize prophecy's advancing. It is both sobering and it's exciting, and those feelings are both natural. When you hear that Slobodan Milosevic was removed in Yugoslavia, and you see the tremendous demonstrations and violence, it may not be quite as clear what's going on there, except that two world wars have started in the Balkans, which is where Yugoslavia is, and you know Europe is boiling and bubbling, and everybody watches things like that. As a matter of fact, I probably will give a sermon soon on the 10 most important things to watch. On the other hand, there are other things that are happening that do not seem quite as obviously exciting. Certainly sobering, scary sobering, but not exciting in the same way, and yet they are an advancing of prophecy. I would like to read you an article that I read 11 and a half years ago, and it shocked me, it changed me in its own way, and I began to read more about it, and it changed my view to a large degree. It was written April 11th, 1989, and it changed my view of what I should be focusing on in terms of the overall advance of prophecy. It's entitled, America's Beirut's Scandalize the Nation, from U.S. News and World Report. All familiar with that. 20 years after nightly news programs spilled the carnage of Vietnam into our living rooms, television and daily newspapers are bringing us live another escalating war that we are losing, the article says. But this time the firefights are taking place on our own territory within the hearts of our major cities. Every day there are haunting pictures of the dead being carried off in body bags, of angry, grieving families. I've often said, my last day when I drove out of New York City, the last thing I saw, quite literally on the highway as I sort of thought about New York City as I watched them zipping a fellow into a body bag, and was on the side of the highway where typically people are dumped when a hit has been made on them. I've never forgotten that. Being carried off in body bags, back to the quote, of angry, grieving families, of commandos breaking down doors, of dilapidated buildings, of armed gangs and wounded children, of burned out cars and the flash of gunfire. The image that overrides all others is that of an urban war zone. From gangland L.A. to the murder capital, Washington, D.C., city after city now tolerates its own Beirut. That is a no-man's land where drug dealers shoot it out to command street corners, where children grow up under a reign of narco-terror, and civil authority has basically broken down. Police confirm that identifiable geographical areas with combat-like conditions exist in more than a dozen major cities. Now, this is outdated. There are far more than that now, surveyed by U.S. News correspondents. They include New York. I'll tell you about that one more in a minute. Boston, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Washington, Miami, Cleveland, East St. Louis, Detroit, Chicago, Atlanta, New Orleans, Houston, Dallas, Oakland, and Los Angeles. That's 16. And it says it includes them. There are certainly others. I remember at one point, and I've lost track, 1,400 people were killed in New York City. They were murdered. The next year it was 2,200, and the next year it was 3,000. And that was in the early part of this last decade, after this article was written, by the way. I think that was about 92, 93, and 94. That's a terribly high number. A terribly high number. Three is a high number. Now, sometimes, as we are witnessing here in this area, people outside this area will not know this story, so I'll fill you in a moment before I read on. We had a woman fake a pregnancy. For 9 months, fooled everybody in her immediate and extended family. Baby showers were held for this woman who so wanted a baby. You know her name. You've seen her picture and the terrible crime she depicted on the front page every single day this week of the Akron Beacon Journal. So on behalf of those who are outside this area, I will just say this woman so wanted a baby, she kidnapped a woman who was about 6 days from delivery, shot her in the head, and before it was too late, you have to take the baby within 6 minutes, cut the woman open and pulled the baby out and claimed it to be her own. And her husband had no idea that she hadn't been pregnant, that it wasn't his son, or that a terrible, brutal murder that had ended with her digging a hole in the corner of the garage, dumping this woman in there like a sack of flour, and then putting a load of stone over the top of it, apparently unknown by the husband as to why she did it, all happened, and he thinks he has a little son. An incredibly sick society. Whether it's one case like that, and you hear the whole thing, and it's graphic, and it's front page, and it's pictures of this woman over and over again, or it's just thousands in the little Beiruts across this country. In some ways, most of the people dying in those little Beiruts are just statistics. It goes on. These local Beiruts look like war zones, too. Unmaintained public housing is literally crumbling. Garbage piles up obscenely in vacant lots, attracting haulers who illegally dump tons more from trucks. Ambulances, firefighters, and utility workers often request police escorts if they will go in at all. Like mass units in war, overburdened war zone police districts apply triage to crime reports, focusing mainly on murders and shootings and ignoring burglaries. Implicitly, if not explicitly, many have adopted a policy of crime containment rather than prevention. Quote, why not let the bozos shoot it out, then go in, pick up the bodies, and arrest the winner, says Cleveland Detective Doug Charney. As one guy said, let them all shoot each other and let God sort them out. And that happens. Well, of course, a lot of the article talks about drugs and all of the other things that are tied in, poverty. It's in all neighborhoods. It cuts across all ethnic groups. It's happening all over the world. It cuts across all of the economic strata of society. It just starts where people are in poverty. But human nature is human nature, brethren. where you bring in drugs, you bring in all of the problems complicit with drugs. Prostitution, murder, and every form of lawlessness you can imagine. The drug problem and its accompanying violence, I'm finishing the article, have clearly outstripped the resources and capability of local governments, police departments, courts, and prisons to cope with them. The phenomenon we're witnessing in Washington is not one the criminal justice system, as originally conceived, was really designed to deal with, says Jay Stevens, U.S. Attorney for Washington, D.C. It was designed as a system to deal with aberrant behavior. What we're seeing now is not aberrant criminal behavior, but widespread disregard for the law and lawlessness. And I cannot help but think of a verse we often quote in a context, brethren of the church, Matthew 24:12. I quoted it last week and often, and it says, because lawlessness, that's iniquity, abounds, the love of many waxes cold. Well, it happens out in society. Love grows cold wherever you have widespread lawlessness. Young kids can get hold of guns and do terrible things. I'll come back to some other articles in a moment. Now, when I read that article about America's Beirut's scandalize the nation, it changed me. I can't quite explain how, except that it changed my understanding of what we ought to be watching for. From that moment forward, I began to analyze what was it Christ said it would be like at the end of the age. Yes, Europe would come together. Yes, the Catholic Church would ride a beast at the end. Yes, there would be events in the Middle East. Yes, oil would be involved. Yes, certain countries would play certain roles. Yes, there would be famine and disease and war and other things. But Christ said you'd really know it was the end when it became like Noah's day, where the whole society was corrupt. Nobody was righteous. When it became like Sodom and Gomorrah, the whole society was rotten. Nobody was righteous. Eight got out of one circumstance. Three people, Lot and his daughters, got out of another. His wife didn't get very far out, so we won't count her. And I began to realize we better start watching people's conduct out there in the world. Now, this week, we had two debates. We had debates on Tuesday night, a debate on Tuesday night for 90 minutes, first of three, between the presidential candidates. On Thursday night, the vice presidential candidates also debated, and this is the only time that they will. Fascinating to watch. Now, on Wednesday morning, a kind of a scorecard came out of how the various different candidates on the presidential Tuesday night debate fared in terms of the polls. And I looked down through all these different categories of how people voted. They voted on who had the most experience to be president. And they all typed in. Tens of thousands of people responded to this CNN poll. Wednesday morning, you could go to the CNN website and it would tell you how people felt about it. They wanted to know about who had the best experience, who had the most leadership qualities to be president, who would do a better job of controlling future oil prices, who would use the presidency to overturn the FDA approval of the abortion pill, who would be the best president for Supreme Court appointments, who after the debate did you think would better deal with President Slobodan Milosevic, who had the best approach to the state of the United States military, who had the best policies on Social Security, Medicare, and taxes? Who had the best approach to education, federal money, and accountability? Who had the best approach to handling crisis situations? Who was cut out of better cloth? Who had the best attitude toward a government intervention in a crisis? For instance, the failure of a major financial institution. Who had a better approach toward the future of Social Security? Who had better character than his opponent? Who had the best closing statements? And finally, who had the best command of issues, persuasiveness, presidential image, stayed on the topics, who had the best overall performance? And here was another one that they list first. Who cares about people like me? They wanted to know what people felt about whether or not the candidates cared about them. Now, that's an interesting statement. When you've seen a country and a whole world melt down into the kind of condition where you find in Ezekiel chapter 21 and 2, and you don't have to turn over there, I don't know how many times it says there will be blood in the streets, blood in the streets, blood in the streets, bodies, blood, blood, bodies, bodies, as God describes this country. The Ezekiel warning of the whole book of Ezekiel describes terrible conditions. But one of the worst conditions of all is just the amount of the tremendous amount of slaughter, mindless murdering of police, of the common person in the street, whether it's drug dealers killing drug dealers, innocent people who are shot so somebody can steal $5 out of their pocket. It's astonishing how violent the society is becoming. That article that I quoted earlier shocked me. It changed me. And I realized I had better not forget that it is more than the march of Europe toward unity, more than the escalating violence on the Temple Mount. This has been a very bad week if you live near the Temple Mount because of what's going on there. And that's fascinating to watch that play out. 29 people, I think, were killed on Tuesday on the Temple Mount alone. And the whole place there is becoming, by the way, a war zone. But you can forget that 29 people died, and you can just sort of say, wow, it's coming together. And I wonder when they'll start to build a temple and what will happen, and will the Vatican move in, as Daniel 11 says they will, and how and when and so forth. And you forget people are dying, and horrible atrocities are taking place. Now I'd like to shift away from that for a moment to an event that took place this week. There is an awful lot of additional violence that is beginning to appear in the various different rock music groups that are out there. Groups like the one called Kill Your Mother and Eat Your Sister doesn't exactly give you a warm feeling in your heart when you hear the name of the group. Or Public Enemy doesn't exactly just, you know, make me want to put my hand over my heart. Or a group called Anthrax. You know what anthrax is? It's a deadly toxin that kills anyone who comes in contact with it horribly in about 5 days. That's what anthrax is. Now, granted, you can laugh at certain groups with a name like Bad English. That's the name of one group. Nobody'd ever want to name themselves Good English, because that wouldn't play. You can wonder, well, what is a group like Two Live Crew? Now, what does that mean? Is that good? Is that bad? Hard to know. It's a little strange. When I read one called Guns N' Roses, that one makes me wonder a little bit more. Black Sabbath, don't get a good feeling about that. And so forth. Vixen, I'm reading some that are older. There's some now. I mean, you know, the Fine Young Cannibals. Now, I don't know. The Fine Young Cannibals. They've been around, I think, since the 80s. They're still around. Some of these names are so sick, so twisted, that you wonder, what is wrong with a society that is attracted to that kind of a group? There's another group out there called The Ministry. You know, of course, being a minister, I just somehow don't think that's related to anything I do. You know, Cool and the Gang, that's not a particularly bad name for a group, and so forth. But when you hear, for instance, this week, Allen Iverson, a pro basketball player who makes, what, $12, $14 million a year, put out an album. In it, he talked about being man enough to pull your gun and use it. And, you know, presumably, as I understood the articles I read, it caused an outrage. And he sort of apologized and said, if it offends gays, of course, I think his album suggests you shoot them on sight. I don't know how you could say if it offends gays. And if it offends some other group that he was talking about, then I'm sorry. But what the lyrics do is challenge young men to carry guns, and then if you are man enough to pull it out and use it, it just glorifies you. Well, in a free society, you can't stop people from saying that kind of thing. And young people are cutting their teeth on it. And, of course, they're cutting their teeth on programs like Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Never seen the show Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Dark Angel. So many programs that glory in sex and violence. You know, Third Watch, NYPD Blue's been around for a number of years. I think it's still out there. Sex and violence. Titans, the new sex show. Dark Angel, I referred to. Sex and the City, one of the vilest programs you ever saw in your life. And it's on in prime time on home box office, which I don't know how many millions of homes get. The Sopranos, I've never seen that. I watched 5 or 10 minutes one time, so maybe I should say, yes, I have seen part of one, and it made me sick. The Practice, you know, L.A. Law, there's a lot of programs out there that basically show people as stone cold and hard. I remember driving in August of 1974 and listening on the radio when President Ford took over for, resigned as of that day, resigned President Nixon. And I remember feeling hurt and this sense of tremendous sadness. I was driving through Virginia at the time, listening on the radio to President Ford pardon him, which probably cost President Ford a second term. He never could recover from that because people so despised President Nixon, who in many ways was a great leader. I'm not here to debate President Nixon. He's been gone for about 6.5 years now. But the point is, I remember feeling terribly sad for the country. The country had been traumatized. I knew that. I didn't know how bad it would be. But I, of course, don't have to tell you that ever since that time, the whole country has referred to the Nixon years, the Watergate years, and they led to, that very term led to all kinds of other terms like Monica Gate, China Gate, you know, and various other scandal gates, but it always had the word gate after it because it was kind of this benchmark in American history that changed people's respect for the government. And people now are interested in a government that cares. And so you watch all of the candidates scramble around trying to appear to be the leader that most cares about people while so much coldness is developing because lawlessness is spreading. People are tired of leaders far away who do not care. Now, I'm going to ask you a question. Would you consider yourself to be soft as a person? Most people are afraid to be considered a softy. I don't know. It's sort of as though it's effeminate, maybe. It's weak. It may be associated with being soft-headed, not just soft-hearted. We're going to be looking at a lot of scriptures here in a moment. But, you know, I once sat down and I decided to listened, or a kind of list, rather, all of the different names of the actors who were the favorites down through the years that America had cut their teeth on literally for generations. I went all the way back to the 30s, and I started looking at the ones that my parents talked about when they were teenagers in the 30s, and, you know, and I began to realize most of them, and a lot of you will not know some of these names if you go way back, but you'll know some of the names that I will mention that come more toward our time. You can go all the way back to Alan Ladd and Gary Cooper. They were stone-faced people. They're absolutely stone-faced. If you look at them, Arnold Schwarzenegger would have fit in the 30s just as easily as he fits in the 80s and the 90s. You know, with Terminator. And it's just that Arnold Schwarzenegger probably never played in a Western. John Wayne is considered an actor for the ages, not because he could act very well. He did get an Oscar, I guess, once. But John Wayne basically had one look on his face all the time, and it was the tough guy, the hard guy. Clint Eastwood, Dirty Harry. How many millions and millions of people all over the world identified with Make My Day because he wanted to shoot this guy, and eventually he got to shoot the guy. And, you know, the famous line where he walks in and he says, well, how are you going to shoot all of us? And the guy says, what do you mean all of us? And Eastwood says, well, me and Smith and Wesson. He pulls out his gun and blows this guy away. Humphrey Bogart was a tough guy. but jump forward, you know. Sylvester Stallone, hard, tough guy. Sean Connery played James Bond, the first James Bond, then Roger Moore, and now Pierce Brosnan, and maybe there was somebody else in there, I'm not sure. I think there was another guy who played one or two in there. I mean, then there's the ultimate tough guy, Charles Bronson. I mean, you all remember the series of Death Wish, and then more Death Wishes, and whatever else the sequels were called. I can't remember them all. I mean, nobody identifies with Dudley Moore. They identify with Roger Moore. You know, Dudley Moore, he's kind of the falling down drunk actor. Who out there identifies with Red Buttons, Mickey Rooney, Laurel and Hardy, Rich Little, or Jerry Lewis? Red Skelton. You know, nobody does. They identify with the tough guys. You know, Shaft. Burt Reynolds can play both ways. Burt Lancaster, tough guy. Kojak. And so forth. Of course, you got the modern tough guys, too. Bruce Willis, always a twinkle in his eye, but look at the movies he's played in. I mean, Die Hard, Die Hard 2, Die Hard 3, and Die Harder and Harder, and whatever else the names they were. You know, Lee Marvin could be funny, but, I mean, you see him in The Dirty Dozen, and some of the movies these guys were in, who's the shaved-headed fella who died of cancer and said, don't smoke, played in The Magnificent Seven, I can't. Yul Brynner, same way. I mean, deep voice, thundering guy, strong silent types. Now, I want to ask you a question. Turn to Mark chapter 1. Time to look at the Bible. We're going to look at a lot of verses. But Mark chapter 1. Suppose Christ had been a strong silent type. Believe me, what's happening out there in society is enough to make you that way. Certainly enough to make you the strong silent cold type. We've lived now for how many generations where it's not considered masculine for a man to cry? Did Christ ever cry? That's a question you might want to ask yourself. We'll look at some fascinating prophecies in terms of the other half of this sermon that really is about prophecy, even though I said it was not. Mark chapter 1 and verse 40. And there came a leper to him, beseeching him, and kneeling down to him. Now, I've never had a leper come to me beseeching. That's King James. That means begging him, imploring him. And kneeling down to him. And saying unto him, if you will, you can make me clean. I've never had that happen. I've had people ask me to anoint them. I've never had anybody, and I don't think any of you have ever had somebody kneel down and beg you to heal them. And it's interesting, it says, and Jesus, moved with compassion, put forth his hand and touched him and said unto him, I will, be you clean. I received a letter from a fellow the other day. It's his third letter, and I won't say too much about it, but he's begging me for help in a certain way. I'm told that this guy tends to do this. And you sort of wonder, is somebody setting you up when they ask for help? This leper was not. I think from what I understand, this guy who's writing me is begging me. He puts beg in great big words and in big letters and red and underlines it and then draws through it with ink. So I'll just see the word beg jump off the page, and he has the word beg 6, 7, 8 times. I've been a minister 30 years. I've never gotten letters like this. Just begging for help. And then I saw what he wanted, and he asked for this staggering amount of money. I don't know this man. He isn't even in the Restored Church of God, and he said so. And then I wrote him back, and I said, well, you're not even in Restored. And, you know, some people seemed to know him and said, don't do it. And then he wrote back and said, well, no, I am in Restored. You misread my letter. Well, the letter said he wasn't, and I didn't misread the letter, and I began to realize, wait a minute. But then you can, because you see people like that, kind of close the bowels of mercies that James talked about, and you could then find yourself being unable to be moved with compassion when a leper comes to you and says, please heal me. I'm summarizing it. And Christ was moved with compassion and put his hands on him. It was literally a touching moment. You know, when they say, well, it was touching, it's because when you touch somebody, it's kind of a statement. Now, some people are real touchy-feely. Other people are real cold and don't do it at all. And I'm not going to stand up here and give you the balance or the guideline. We know that in the early New Testament church, people greeted each other with a holy kiss. We know in a society obsessed with sex today that the right hand to fellowship is better, and they also did that. So touching can be one kind of way. It can be another kind of way. Custom to whom custom, it can change. But you all understand that people touch each other. Today, a lot of sick people touch people in the wrong way. So you have to be careful. But you all understand when it says it was a touching moment. There are moments where you reach over, put your hand on somebody's shoulder, they need encouragement, and it's touching, literally. Well, Christ touched him. And Christ was touched by the request. And of course, the leprosy departed in verse 42, and he was cleansed. In Mark chapter 6, let's stay in Mark for a little while. Mark chapter 6, let's read a longer account. Verse 30, and the apostles gathered themselves together to Jesus and told him all things, both what they'd done and what they had taught. And he said to them, verse 31, come you yourselves apart unto a desert place and rest a while, for there were many coming and going, and they had no leisure so much as to eat. You can be so busy you don't have time to eat. Now, I'll make a confession to you. And the people in the office staff know it, and it's in a way, it's, I'm not trying to say it for any other reason, it's just partly the way I am. I eat a little breakfast in the morning, and then I eat at night, period. I do not eat during the day at all. But do you know what? I don't even think about it because I roar around all day long, and I sometimes, maybe twice a week, my wife cuts me vegetables. I used to have arthritis, so I eat a lot of cut vegetables, and sometimes I'll eat raw, organic cut vegetables. My wife will tell you, more often than not, she cuts them, puts them in my briefcase. I bring them into work, set them down where I'll see them, and I'm still too busy to eat them, and I take them home and put them back in the refrigerator and tell myself I better eat them tomorrow or they're shot, and so I try not to go 2 days in a row, but I probably don't eat my vegetables more than about 2 days a week, and that's all I eat for lunch, and I'm not even hungry. I take time to drink coffee, and that's probably not good if I drink too much. It's an appetite suppressant. But I understand, I'm just making the point, I understand what it means when they said, and they had no leisure so much as to eat. We race around. We're very busy here, and we go a long time. And I have to tell you, when I sit down at the end of a day where I usually eat nothing but maybe a few vegetables, which is about 95% water, if you know what they are, I still, when I sit down and eat, my wife will tell you I don't eat much for dinner because I can't unwind fast enough, even at 7 o'clock, and I only eat a little fruit and a little bowl in the morning of grains. That's all I have for breakfast, and I usually can't finish that. I'm not losing weight. I feel great, but the point is, you know, I've reached a stage in my life where either food doesn't attract me, or else it's just I'm going so much I don't have an appetite. I can understand this circumstance. I'm telling you that because we're going to read a story about food, all right? And they departed into a desert place by ship privately. And the people saw them departing, and many knew him, and ran afoot thither out of all cities, and outwent them, and came together to him. And Jesus, when he came out, saw much people, and was moved with compassion toward them. He cared about people, because they were as sheep, not having a shepherd, and he began to teach them many things. And when the day was now far spent, his disciples came to him and said, this is a desert place, and now the time is far past. Send them away, that they may go into the country round about, and into the villages, and buy themselves bread, for they have nothing to eat. He answered and said to them, give you them to eat? And they said to him, shall we go and buy 200 pennyworth of bread and give them to eat? He said to them, how many loaves have you? Go and see. When they knew, they said, 5 and 2 fishes. And he commanded them to make all sit down by companies upon the green grass, and they sat down in ranks by hundreds and by fifties. So people were very orderly, even though they were hungry. And when he had taken the 5 loaves and 2 fishes, he looked up to heaven and blessed and broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples to set before them, and the 2 fishes divided he among them all. And they did all eat and were filled. And they took up 12 baskets full of the fragments of the fishes. And they did eat of the loaves, and they that did eat were about 5,000 men. Now, what about women and children? Families typically were big. Can you imagine? Would there have been 20,000, 30,000 people? 5,000 men, I don't think that Christ would have said, men first, women and kids, you starve. Of course not, I'm being facetious. And so they still lined up hundreds and fifties. Amazing to see that. And straightway, he constrained his disciples to get into the ship and to go on the other side before Bethsaida while he sent away the people. And when he had sent them away, he departed into a mountain to pray. And when even was come, the ship was in the midst of the sea, and he alone on the land, and he saw them toiling and rowing, for the wind was contrary to him. And about the fourth watch of the night he came to them, walking upon the sea, and would have passed by them. But when they saw him walking upon the sea, they supposed it had been a spirit. They thought, oh, it's a demon, and cried out. For they all saw him and were troubled. And immediately he talked with them and said to them, be of good cheer, it's I, don't be afraid. And he went up unto them into the ship, and the wind ceased. And they were sore amazed in themselves beyond measure and wondered. And then it says something strange. For they considered not the miracle of the loaves, for their heart was hardened. In other words, they didn't realize that Christ was moved with compassion, fed 10, 20, 30,000 people. He wasn't going to let them die in the ship and or be attacked by a demon, because they didn't understand what the miracle of the loaves was about. Why? Their heart was hardened. It was hardened. Not in the sense that God hardened Pharaoh's heart. Their heart was just hard. It was hard. They didn't realize that Christ cared about people. Chapter 8 and verse 1. In those days, the multitude being very great, and having nothing to eat, Jesus called his disciples unto him and said to them, I have compassion on the multitude. Well, it's a different account, two chapters later. Because they have now been with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. Now, did they run out of food at the end of 3 days? Or had they gone 3 days and hadn't eaten? And they were so zealous to hear the truth, they'd been on a 3-day fast. And if I send them away fasting to their own homes, it sounds like they had not eaten for 3 days. Because they were already into a fast. Now, if it's just time to eat and there's nothing to eat, you wouldn't say you send them home fasting. You'd say you just go on home and eat. It sounds like they were really hungry. They'd stayed a long time, which makes a tremendous statement about the zeal of people and how tough people were. Today, people think if they don't eat for a day, they'll die. There are people that come into God's church. There are a great many people out there in the world who literally think if they don't eat for a day, because they have no idea what the Bible says, that they will die. They will actually die. They believe that. Well, here were people who went 3 days because they were so excited, they didn't even have God's Spirit, and at that point they were hungry. They will faint, by the way, they won't get home, for various of them came from far. And his disciples answered him, from whence can a man satisfy these men with bread here in the wilderness? Now, they just seen the miracle of the fish and loaves. A couple chapters earlier, not very long earlier. I don't know how long between the couple chapters, but very, very brief, I suspect. And he asked them, how many loaves have you? And they said, 7. Different situation. Commanded the people to sit down on the ground, took the 7 loaves, gave thanks, and broke, and gave to his disciples to set before them. They did set them before the people. And they had a few small fishes, so there were a few fishes, and he blessed, commanded to set them before them, so they did eat and were filled, and they took up of the broken meat that was left 7 baskets, not 7 loaves and a few fishes. And they that had eaten were about 4,000, and he sent them away. Now, maybe 4,000 total. Doesn't say 5,000 men, but, you know, you think of the feeding of the 5,000. Everybody's familiar with that story. Well, there's also the feeding of the 4,000. And the feeding of the 5,000 was probably 20 or 30,000, who knows, depending upon kids and what have you. So Christ was moved with compassion in all of those cases, whether it was feeding 2 groups that were very hungry or it was healing a leper who knelt down and begged him. Turn to John 11. Now here's a more remarkable story. It shows how human beings can care, but care in the wrong way. John chapter 11. Now a certain man was sick named Lazarus of Bethany, the town of Mary and her sister, Martha. It was that Mary which anointed the Lord with ointment, wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. Therefore his sisters sent to him, saying, Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick. When Jesus heard that, he said, this sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God might be glorified thereby. Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. When he had heard, therefore, that he was sick, he abode 2 days still in the same place where he was. He didn't appear to be in a very big hurry, did he? Then after that, said he to his disciples, let us go to Judea again. His disciples said to him, Master, the Jews have late sought to stone you, and go you there again? Christ answered, are there not 12 hours in the day? One of my favorite verses these days. If any man walk in the day, he stumbles not, because he sees the light of this world. But if a man walk in the night, he stumbles, because there is no light in him. These things said he, and after that he said to them, our friend Lazarus sleeps, but I go that I may awake him out of sleep. Then said his disciples, they didn't get the point, they missed it, Lord, if he sleep, he'll do well, he'll wake up, he'll be fine, he's probably getting some rest. Howbeit Jesus spoke of his death, but they thought that he had spoken of taking of rest and sleep. Then said Jesus to them plainly, no, what I'm saying is, Lazarus is dead, and I am glad for your sakes that I was not there, to the intent that you may believe. Nevertheless, let us go to him. Then said Thomas, which is called Didymus, unto his fellow disciples, let us go also go that we may die with him. Missed the point, wouldn't you say? Then when Jesus came, he found that he had lain in the grave 4 days already. Now Bethany was nigh to Jerusalem, about 15 furlongs, about 2 miles off. And many of the Jews came to Martha and Mary to comfort her concerning her brother. As soon as she heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him, but Mary sat still in the house. Then said Martha to Jesus, Lord, if you'd been here, my brother had not died. But I know that even now, whatsoever you will ask of God, God will give it you. Jesus said to her, your brother shall rise again. Now Martha said to him, I know that he shall rise again in the resurrection at the last day. See, the Jews knew about the resurrection. Jesus said unto her, I am the resurrection. You don't have to wait till the last day. I'm the resurrection. If I want him to be resurrected now, no problem. And the life, he that believes on me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. And whosoever lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? She said to him, yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, which should come into the world. Now, a little shaky on whether or not he could resurrect anybody. And when she had so said, she went her way and called Mary, her sister, secretly, saying, the Master has come and calls for you. Well, she rose quickly and came to him. Now, Jesus was not yet come into town, but was in that place where Martha met him. The Jews then, which were with her in the house and comforted her, when they saw Mary, that she rose up hastily and went out, followed her, saying, she goes to the grave to weep there. Very touching moment. Then when Mary was come where Jesus was and saw him, she fell down at his feet, saying to him, Lord, if you had been here, my brother had not died. Touching moment. When Jesus therefore saw her weeping, and the Jews also weeping which came with her, notice it says, he groaned in the spirit and was troubled. It touched him. He didn't reach out and touch anybody here yet, but he was touched. Further proof, and said, where have you laid him? They said unto him, Lord, come and see. Now here is the God of the entire universe, who made all human beings, had seen a tremendous amount of death, destruction, had actually authored the great flood where all but 8 died. And it still says, Jesus wept. Now, about all that verse means to most people is the answer to a trivia question. What's the shortest verse in the Bible? Oh, Jesus wept. But you know what? The verse is, Jesus wept. Then said the Jews, behold how he loved him. And some of them said, could not this man which opened the eyes of the blind have caused that even this man should not have died? They didn't see that it wasn't too late yet. Jesus, therefore, again, groaning in himself. Now, did you hear him groaning? No. Groaning in himself. Groaned in the spirit, it says. Brethren, you ever groaned in yourself? You hear people groan in pain, but have you ever groaned in yourself? Do you understand the feeling? Would you say, yes, I can identify with that. He came to the grave. It was a cave and a stone laid upon it. Jesus said, take you away the stone. Martha, the sister of him that was dead, said to him, now this is kind of interesting, she didn't really believe
that he could resurrect him, because she said, well, Lord, by this time he stinks, for he's been dead 4 days. Very carnal reasoning, although she'd sort of hoped if you wanted to, you could heal him, but she didn't really believe it. But, you know, she didn't stop and say, wait a minute, she said, roll away the stone. It's not because he's interested in smelling dead flesh 4 days, you know, 4 days old. He said to her, said I not unto you that if you would believe, you should see the glory of God? They took away the stone from the place where the dead was laid. Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. And I knew that you hear me always, but because of the people which stand by, I said it, that they may believe that you have sent me. And when he thus had spoken, he cried with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. And he that was dead came forth, bound hand and foot with grave clothes. What a stunning picture. And his face was bound about with a napkin. Jesus said to them, loose him and let him go. Now that's an amazing story. The disciples said, well, let's go. People didn't understand. There was weeping and heavy feelings. And finally Thomas said, well, yeah, okay, let's go and we'll die with him. Sounds noble, but he didn't feel what was going on. He didn't understand. Still kind of in the spirit of not considering the miracle of the loaves and the fishes. Matthew chapter 23. Then spoke Jesus to the multitude and to his disciples, saying, the scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. All therefore whatsoever they bid you observe, that observe and do, but do you not after their works, for they say and do not. For they bind heavy burdens and grievous to be borne, and lay them on men's shoulders. But they themselves will not move them with one of their fingers. They won't do anything. They love having the leadership, but they don't actually serve or help. But all their works they do for to be seen of men. Boy, have I seen a lot of people who serve to be seen by people. And when nobody's around, they don't do the dirty work. They do the high-profile serving. A lot of those people have come and gone in the church of God through the years. They make broad their phylacteries and enlarge the borders of their garments. All of this religious trinketry, really, to look like they were religious. Verse 11, he that's greatest among you shall be your servant. Verse 13, woe unto you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites. Verse 14, woe unto you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites. 15, same thing. Verse 16, woe unto you, you blind guides. Verse 17, you fools and blind. Strong. But if that's, you know, that's not as strong as what we're coming to. Verse 23, woe unto you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites. 24, you blind guides. Woe to you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites. You blind Pharisees, 26. In other words, you don't really care about people. You want to look religious, but you don't care about human beings. Verse 27, I don't know if you're counting them. I haven't counted them. Woe unto you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites. And verse 33, you serpents, you generation of vipers, deadly snakes. Wherefore, behold, I send unto you prophets and wise men and scribes, and some of them you shall kill and crucify, and some of them you shall scourge in your synagogues, and persecute them from city to city, that upon you may come all the righteous blood shed upon the earth from the blood of righteous Abel. Religious people who were absolutely unfeeling toward their fellow man. Verse 37, fascinating and an inspiring verse about how the very same Christ who'd said all those things could now say this. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you that kill the prophets and stone them which are sent unto you, how often would I have gathered your children together, even as a hen gathers her chickens. What a touching. Have you ever watched a hen gather her chickens? You say, oh, she's just like a mother hen, we say of women. A hen will run over and kind of push the little chicken over and go over here and run around. The typical mother hen will just bring the little chickens back together. And you would not. What a touching moment where Christ stands and looks over Jerusalem and says, I so wanted to gather you, but you've done all these terrible things. He could see one, and it didn't harden him. He still cared. Behold, your house is left unto you desolate. And that's, of course, what happened. Hebrews 4:15. Hebrews 4 and verse 15. For we have not a high priest which cannot be touched with the feeling of our infirmities, but was in all points tempted like as we are, yet without sin. Did you see that? We do not have a high priest which cannot be touched. And I mentioned that there were my father's notes were in the Bible here, and I will just tell you in his handwriting I found in the Bible, Jesus Christ is my high priest. I can't even remember exactly how he phrased it there. Pull it out and just read it, because I never want to lose this just because it's in my dad's handwriting. Jesus Christ prays to the Father for me as high priest. And that was the only notes I found sticking in this brand new Bible my dad bought before he died. You know, Christ can be touched with the feeling of our infirmities because he felt temptation. He can be moved with compassion. The results for you, brethren, and me is go boldly to his throne. Don't tiptoe. Say, well, you know, I'm kind of here, Christ, and I hope you're impressed by the shameful shuffle that I'm doing, and, you know, you're bobbing back and forth and looking down and blushing and feeling embarrassed. No, you go to God boldly that you may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need, because he cares. Because Christ can be touched, brethren. When you have concerns, now or in the future, he can be touched. He is a being who has touched people, who has been touched, and can be touched. James 5 and verse 11. Turn back just a few pages. James 5 and verse 11. Behold, we count them happy which endure. You have heard of the patience of Job and have seen the end of the Lord, the goal, the aim, what is kind of what the Lord is, the end of the Lord. That's what it means. Doesn't mean the end of the Lord. He's gone. That the Lord is very pitiful and of tender mercy. Well, of course, it doesn't mean you looked at Christ and you said, man, what a pitiful sight. It means Christ is full of pity. Somebody says, I pity you. That's usually used in a way that is not very apropos. He's full of pity. He cared about people. You know, in the end, whether it's a political election, whether it's children toward their parents, whether it's people in the church, whether it's people toward God, people want to know that other people care. We live in a society that will try to squeeze from you your feelings, frankly, for anybody but yourself or myself. Turn to Jeremiah and let's contrast Jeremiah to the people he saw. It used to be a national quality, brethren, that people tended to care more about other people. Now people want politicians who care, but a lot of those very same people don't care about anybody but themselves. And they're very interested in other people caring for them and the government solving their problems. But, you know, I wonder about all of the people who don't seem to care about making changes at the grassroots level in their own lives and in their own neighborhoods. Somehow people have fallen back on the belief that the government has to do it for you. And unfortunately, people who want to be elected and need votes, they want something from people. It's created a need to have to give them something in return for their votes. So people can say, I'll know you care about me if you give me programs. You do things for me, and then I'll give you my vote. And I'll tell you, in a democracy, leaders are subject to people who want them to care. And it's the wrong kind of caring, because then the politicians will take polls. What do people care about? What are the issues? I was listening to the national news last night and about got sick. Each party will spend $250,000 per month alone just analyzing the polls before the candidate goes into, for instance, Central Florida. What do they care about right in Central Florida? The pollsters will go in, find out what's on the minds of the people in Central Florida a couple days before he arrives, and then he'll use the buzzwords and the terms and the phrases and talk about the programs that'll cause people in Central Florida to vote for them. Now, Central Wyoming, it's different. Or Northern Maine, it's different. They take polls there. $250,000 per month, per party, by the way, per party. That's $500,000 a month over the course of, you know, a four-month campaign. 4 months, I mean, that's since the time they were nominated, maybe 3 months. That's $1.5 million. And polls go long before that, just finding out what's on people's minds. So you can say the right things, use the right kind of terms. One of the terms they want to hear is compassionate conservative. I'm conservative, but conservative by the liberals, who are often depicted as bleeding hearts, is made to be considered hard-hearted. So, somebody came up with this wonderful term, I'm a compassionate conservative. I can be conservative, but I can be compassionate. And it plays well, so that'll be used for a while, and eventually it'll go into disuse. Jeremiah chapter 5. Jeremiah chapter 5. There'll be some other term that will be coined by a speech writer, and he'll say, try this phrase and see if you can get votes. And it's also hollow and hypocritical. Jeremiah chapter 5 and verse 3. O Lord, are not your eyes upon the truth? You have stricken them, but they have not grieved. You have consumed them, but they have refused to receive correction. They have made their faces harder than a rock. They have refused to return. Jeremiah said of the people in the modern nations of Israel. Ever see people with faces harder than a rock? Chapter 6 and verse 15. Were they ashamed when they had committed abomination? No, they were not at all ashamed. Neither could they blush. I mean, it's like, we have the term, have you no shame? You know what God says? We're reaching a time in this country where nobody is ever ashamed of anything. Nobody blushes about anything. God says, therefore they shall fall among them that fall. At the time that I visit them, they shall be cast down, says the Lord. Verse 28. They are all grievous revolters, walking with slanders. They are, look at this, statement, brass and iron. Double your fist and punch iron sometime. I mean, it's hard as rock, which we already read they are. Brass as well. They are all corruptors. One of the reasons people become revolting and corrupting and walk with slander. Slander is so common, brethren, so common today, is because people don't feel anything. They are hard as rocks inside. You know, they have a hardness of heart. They can witness the God of the universe feeding 5, 10, 15, 20, 30,000 people, and a few minutes later be scared that a demon's coming because they don't understand that Christ cares. Now, we have to be careful that we don't shy away from that, because the Protestant world talks about lovey-dovey social gospel. I call it the Protestant evangelical sweet Jesus social love gospel, which is basically hypocritical. It's no different than the way politicians are. You're saying the right things to get the vote. It's hollow, it's empty, and it's wrong. Jeremiah chapter 4 and verse 19. The whole reason the worldwide church of God really got in trouble is they moved away from the truth of the gospel and went toward that phony stuff. And I see a lot of God's people today fooled by the phony feelings of lovey-dovey, but they don't understand the depth of feelings they should have toward a suffering world where Christ could stand and say, Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you that stoned the prophets, how often I would have gathered you like a hen gathers the chicks, but you would not. We're going to do God's work, brethren, and it can't be just because Mr. Armstrong taught us to do the work. It's got to be because we care about other human beings out there. We care. You love the truth. A person who loves the truth ought to do anything to help other people have that same kind of a first love feeling come to their lives. You know, I haven't gotten to talk to a lot of people in recent years who are coming out of the world and learning the truth for the first time. My wife will tell you, I had a policy. I couldn't wait when I got a new letter down through the years to go see new people, because it was so much fun to work with people who were on fire. And I saw so many people would cool down before I ever understood what was going to happen in the 90s. I saw so many people just ho-hum, another Sabbath, here we go to church, another feast, you know, pay my tithes, you know, don't eat pork, whatever else. And that was kind of Christianity. And of course, later we realized they had just lost what the joy of this way of life, and seeing people changed by the work that consumed Mr. Armstrong did. Jeremiah 4:19. Look at what he says. My bowels, my bowels, my guts is what he's saying. I am pained at the very heart. My heart makes a noise in me. I cannot hold my peace because you have heard, O my soul, the sound of the trumpet and the alarm of war. Destruction upon destruction is cried, for the whole land is spoiled. What was his reaction? He was sick about it. Suddenly are my tents spoiled and my curtains in a moment. How long shall I see the standard and hear the sound of the trumpet? For my people are foolish. They've not known me. They're sottish children, and they have no understanding. They are wise to do evil, but to do good they have no knowledge. Sottish just means stupid. People are stupid. They do things that hurt themselves. Turn to Ephesians chapter 4. Ephesians 4. Is that just something that Jeremiah felt? Ephesians chapter 4. Very, very important verse. Verse 17. This I say therefore, and testify in the Lord, Paul writes to the Ephesians, testify in the Lord, that you henceforth walk not as other Gentiles walk in the vanity of their mind, having the understanding darkened, being alienated from the life of God through the ignorance that is in them because of the blindness of their heart. Look at this. Who being past feeling have given themselves over unto lasciviousness to work all uncleanness with greediness. Why do people fall into trouble in their life, into wrong conduct? They lose the ability to feel. Now, it can be a combination of feeling for others, feeling things that are happening around them. Their own conscience can be seared with a hot iron and they don't feel anything anymore. It's just seared. But it is possible to be past feeling. When people come out of the world and are called into the truth, they begin to feel again. You know, when you go through something shocking, you know what you often say? I'm numb. I'm just numb. Events can numb people. Most of you have probably gone through things where you found yourself saying, I feel numb. I've gone through a lot of things where I found myself saying, I'm just numb. I'm numb by what has happened. But you know, if you go through enough things and you see enough things happening out there in society, you reach a point where you just become past feeling. You're not just numb for a moment at the sudden death of somebody you love, numb that somebody leaves the church, or numb over this or that. You become numb, period. You don't feel anything anymore. And then those people, it says, go off into other things. Their love waxes cold. They don't feel love anymore. And you can now begin to understand from this verse why it's associated with lawlessness. They go into lascivious, unclean, greedy living, and they don't realize they're supposed to feel for other people. They don't feel much themselves either, but they just lose track of that. Back to Jeremiah chapter 8. And verse 18, when I would comfort myself against sorrow, my heart is faint in me. Behold, the voice of the cry of the daughter of my people, because of them that dwell in a far country. Is not the Lord of Zion, is not her king in her? Why have they provoked me to anger with their graven images and with strange vanities? Here's an important verse. Don't forget this one. The harvest is past, the summer is ended, and we are not saved. That's a prophecy we used to mention periodically. I haven't heard it mentioned in years. But there may come a point where there is that last summer of either tremendous drought, the harvest comes, the summer's over, and the food wasn't there. And we are not saved. For the hurt of the daughter of my people, am I hurt? Jeremiah says, my question to all of you brethren is, can you hurt for other people, or do you just hurt when you hurt? For their hurt, am I hurt? I am black. It means I'm astonished. I'm just sick. This dark feeling came over him. Astonishment has taken hold on me. Is there no balm in Gilead? Is there no physician there? Why then is not the health of the daughter of my people recovered? We're in a land, brethren, that is not going to recover until God recovers it. Oh, that my head were waters and my eyes a fountain of tears, that I might weep day and night for the slain of the daughter of my people. Now, he's weeping about a prophecy that he wasn't even living through. Brethren, can we weep? Do you ever just weep because of things you see? Are you ever reading an article and you read about a woman who was just gutted like a fish because somebody pulled a baby out of her, wanted that baby, and then dumped her like a sack of potatoes? Or some little boy is desperate to help his mother feed other little children, so he stands and helps sell crack at age 8 carrying a 25 or a 22, a little 22 pistol, 25, and shoots people because he's got to bring home $200 because his mother's got 4 kids. Can you feel for those people? Or are they getting what they deserve? Oh, that I had in the wilderness a lodging place of wayfaring men, that I might leave my people and go from them, for they're all adulterers, an assembly of treacherous men. They bend their tongues like their bow for lies. We live in a society where people lie all the time. I don't have to tell you that. But they are not valiant for the truth upon the earth, for they proceed from evil to evil. And he just said, I can't stand it anymore. But not because he didn't care. Because you just read. Men added the chapter division. I hurt for them. I cry. I can't stand it anymore. Is that the way you feel, brethren? Do you feel that way? Do you care? Chapter 22. Chapter 22 of Jeremiah. And verse 28. Is this man Jeconiah, a despised broken idol? Is he a vessel wherein is no pleasure? Wherefore are they cast out, he and his seed, and are cast into a land which they know not. Now look at what he says. O earth, 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 hear the word of the Lord. Now it was about this man named Jeconiah who was going to be written childless, it says in the next verse. That was a specific prophecy. But it's interesting, the feeling. You know, it's kind of like, earth, 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 listen, this feeling. Chapter 23 and verse 9. My heart within me is broken. Yeah, you heard the term, I have a broken heart. Well, there it is in the Bible. Jeremiah had a broken heart because of the prophets. All my bones shake. I'm like a drunken man and like a man whom wine has overcome. Just in a stupor, staggering around because of the Lord and because of the words of His holiness. The land is full of adultery and swearing and so forth. Turn to Jude 15. Enoch was the seventh preacher of righteousness. You know that sermon, perhaps. I gave a sermon showing how Enoch was the third great grandson of Seth. He was the seventh preacher of righteousness. Maybe I should say Seth, who was Abel's brother, was the third great grandfather of Enoch. Enoch was the great grandfather of Noah. Enoch got in trouble because he preached a particular message. God had to preserve him and take him away. Verse 14, and Enoch also, the seventh from Adam, prophesied of these, saying, behold, the Lord comes with 10,000s of his saints. Enoch preached the gospel. All the preachers of righteousness, that's what they were called, he was the seventh. Second Peter says Noah was the eighth, preached that the Lord comes with 10,000s of his saints. That's what they preached. It's what Abraham preached. David referred to when God comes to govern the nations. The major prophets, the minor prophets, the apostles, and of course, Mr. Herbert Armstrong preached the gospel of the kingdom of God. So did Abel. So did Seth. So did the others until Enoch became seventh. And then his son and grandson tried to kill him. And then his great-grandson picked up the baton, Noah, and kept preaching that message. That's the gospel. And why is he coming? To execute judgment upon all and to convict all that are ungodly among them of their ungodly deeds, which they have ungodly committed. Now look at this. And of all their hard speeches, which ungodly sinners have spoken against him. You know, people have been very hard toward God, and God is going to convict them. But he's going to set up his government, and he's going to teach them. 1 John 3 and verse 17. 1 John 3 and verse 17, a couple pages back. But whoso has this world's good and sees his brother have need and shuts up his bowels of compassion. Now that's added, okay. That's in in italics, so the King James translators added it, but it's not a bad addition because it shuts up his bowels, as there in the Greek, from him. How dwells the love of God, as the sermonette talked about, in him? If you don't care about other people who have need, my little children, let us not love in word, neither in tongue, but in deed and in truth. If somebody comes to our house, as James said, and you say, you know, depart and be warm and filled, you know, they're hungry and they're cold, and you say, well, depart and be warm and filled, I sure hope it works out for you. That won't cut it. At the end of the age, there are a lot of people who utter hard speeches. Actually, if you look in the Greek, it's interesting. I think the Greek word is skleros. You know, multiple sclerosis, the scarring of the nerves, and these little hard spots, and it causes the nerves to not fire because of these hard spots. I may be wrong on that, but I think multiple sclerosis comes from sclerosis. I just hope I'm describing the right disease. I know there are other ways that sclerosis, that's a scarring of, I think it's the myelin sheath. You know what that word scleros means? Hard, tough, fierce. A lot of people are very hard toward God, very fierce and tough. God says, all right, fine, that's the way you want to be. But God's people must never be that way. Now, staying right here, go to 1 Peter chapter 3, this part of the Bible, I mean. 1 Peter 3. The apostles, you remember, didn't quite get it with Lazarus, didn't quite get it with the feeding of the 5,000, didn't understand, didn't feel, didn't have the compassion Christ did. But later, you find Peter saying, 1 Peter 3:8, finally, be you all of one mind, having compassion one of another. Love as brethren, be pitiful, be courteous. Do we, brethren? I'm going to just keep saying this over and over. I don't care how many of us there are. We have got to live the book. And this is a very key element of Christ's own life that all Christians who are copying him will emulate. Having compassion, pitiful, courteous, not rendering evil for evil or railing for railing, but contrariwise blessing, knowing that you are thereunto called, that you should inherit a blessing. Now, there are people who fall into habits and patterns that reflects that they are hard-hearted. You'll see various things people do. They can become tactless, curt, blunt. They like to order people around. They don't seem to feel. They don't like to read stories that make them uncomfortable when somebody is suffering. I knew a minister who said, I don't like to go to hospitals. I just don't like to be around people that are suffering. I knew one man who didn't want to be around his mother because she was dying, and you know, and didn't want to be around his grandmother. Just it made him uncomfortable. I want to remember where she was. I said, well, wait a minute. Maybe you ought to go see her. You know, she's your grandmother. Why don't you go see her? Maybe it would make her feel good. Well, no, I just don't like to you know, do that. Then when his mother died, he walked out of the funeral. He said it made me uncomfortable. He went over and sat in a bar. And there are people like that. They're very sensitive to themselves. And this particular man, fascinatingly enough, was extremely sensitive of his own feelings. Man, his feelings were like raw nerve endings out on the end of his sleeves. But I will tell you what, he didn't feel much for anybody else at all. So I've seen people, and they say, well, he's very sensitive. Of course, I want to know, and I know generally what that means, are they sensitive to people hurting them, or are they sensitive to when they hurt others? Which are you? Being very sensitive can be a tremendous compliment or a tremendous problem you have to overcome. Are you sensitive to your own feelings being hurt, or are you sensitive to others? Are you typically very critical? Do you use soft answers? A soft answer turns away wrath. Do you do that? Do you care about people? You know, out there in society, you will be taught, you have to be tough to make it. Survival of the fittest. Tough guys are glorified. This world, brethren, at the end of the age, when there has never been more hardness or more people past feeling, This world will try to squeeze from you and I feeling. It will try to squeeze it from us. Turn finally to a couple last verses. Ezekiel, then we're going to go to Ephesians. Ezekiel chapter 9. One woman asked me the other day, Mr. Pack, are we going to do the Ezekiel warning? In other words, Mr. Armstrong talked about the Ezekiel warning. He talked certainly about taking the gospel to the world. Well, I don't know how you can talk about the coming of the kingdom of God without talking about the horrible things that are going to come right in front of it, like we did in the sermon on trumpets. But in Ezekiel chapter 9, he cried also in my ears with a loud voice, saying, cause them that have charge over the city to draw near, even every man with his destroying weapon in his hand. And behold, six men came from the way of the high gate, which lies toward the north, and every man a slaughtering weapon in his hand. And one man among them was clothed with linen, with a writer's inkhorn by his side, and they went in and stood beside the brazen altar. And the glory of the Lord of Israel was gone up from the cherub, whereupon he was to the threshold of the house, and so forth, called to the man clothed with linen, which had the writer's inkhorn by his side. And the Lord said to him, go through the midst of the city. Look carefully, brethren. We all talk about the mark of the beast, and everybody is eventually going to take the mark of the beast. Or they're going to take this mark. Through the midst of Jerusalem, and set a mark upon the foreheads of the men that sigh and that cry for all the abominations that be done in the midst thereof. Now, brethren, I'm here to tell you, every last human being on the face of the earth is going to receive a mark on their forehead. So says your Bible. You will not buy or sell if you do not have the mark of the beast. But do you know that God's people who are sighing and crying, who will not take that mark, will be people who have this mark on them. They're going to be marked on the forehead. You know, we mark people that cause division. The Bible says, mark the perfect man. Well, here's another way where you can be marked, and it's good. You're marked on the forehead by God and preserved. This book of Ezekiel says, as we've covered in other places, from the fire and the sword and the scattering, because you have a mark on your forehead that is given because you care. And you're sickened by, like Jeremiah and Peter and Christ, and so many others, you're sickened by what's going on out there. And to the others he said in my hearing, go out into the city and smite. Let not your eyes spare, neither have you pity. Slay utterly old and young, both maids and little children and women. But come not near any man upon whom is the mark. Have you ever stopped to realize, brethren, you and I will be protected, among other reasons, from the horrors that are coming, if we have this mark, and we'll get this mark, if we sigh and cry and care about and understand and are sickened by what's going on out there. That's why it's so hard for me, brethren, to understand people who don't care to share the truth out there. People who think the work is over are people who need to rev up their feelings. They may be past feeling in ways they shouldn't be. The work of God has to always be done by the true servants of God, because they're people who care. They don't worry about numbers. They don't worry about anything other than going forward and letting God make up the difference. Finally, Ephesians 4. We've been there, but let's go back. Ephesians 4. We don't need, brethren, strong, silent types in God's church. It may work on TV. It may work in novels. It may work in the movies. And by that I mean it gets people to buy them or to go, but we don't need them in God's church. Remember we read in verse 19 of people who, being past feeling, have given themselves over unto lasciviousness to work all uncleanness with greediness. Verse 20, still talking about past feeling. Remember what we've read about Christ when you read, but you have not so learned Christ. That is not what Christ is like. He suffered horribly and died because he cares about people. He wants to be the firstborn of many brethren. There's no room in the church and among God's people for a God sock it to them attitude. Go get them, God. I've obeyed you, but knock out all those heathen. Crush those sinners. Smash this wicked world. Now, God is going to have a year of wrath. But that's His business. It's not the year of the brethren's wrath and the wrath of God. God says, I'll deal with it. Vengeance is mine. I know how to take care of it. I'll reward people according to their works. I want you to sigh and cry, and I'll give you a mark, and you'll be protected in a way that no one else will be protected from if you care. Let me say again. If we find ourselves not having as much feeling as we should, we have not so learned Christ. Brethren, keep your nerve endings soft and tender. Be concerned. Feel. Care. Sigh. Cry. And sometimes, oh yes, weep for what you see out there. And it will keep you much more fervent about why we must do the work.